First, we will hear from Deepakar Bhattacharya and Lyndall Ormsby from the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Program. Deepakar Bhattacharya, or DB, is the University of Kentucky Alumni Chair Professor of Chemical and Materials Engineering, a Fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and Director of the Center of Membrane Sciences. He has published over 200 articles and has 9 U.S. patents in functionalized membranes and water detoxification area. Dr. DB has received a number of awards, and his research and educational accomplishments, including the Gerhold Award from the American Institute of Chemical Engineers Separations Division and the Larry K. Cecil American Institute of Chemical Engineers Environmental Division Award for his outstanding contributions in membrane separations technology development in the water area. He is the editor of a recently published book, Responsive Membranes and Materials, published by John Wiley. Our next speaker will be Lyndall Ormsby. He is the Raymond Blythe Professor of Civil Engineering at the University of Kentucky and the Associate Director of the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Center. Dr. Ormsby's past research efforts have focused on the application of systems analysis methods to complex problems in water resources and environmental systems, with a more recent focus on the development of remediation strategies for chlorinated organic compounds in groundwater. He has over 20 years' experience working on technical and remediation issues associated with the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant, Kentucky's largest Superfund site. From 2003 to 2009, he served as the director of the Kentucky Research Consortium for Energy and Environment, which focused on a range of issues associated with the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant. With that, DB, I think we're turning it over to you now.
Hello, good afternoon, and good morning to people who are in California and Hawaii. My name is DB Bhattacharya, and my co-speaker will be Dr. Lyndall Ormsby in about 20 minutes or so. The title says Nanostructured Membranes for Water Remediations. And most of you are familiar with the membranes probably for reverse osmosis, ultrafiltration, and reverse osmosis dissolving waters. But what I'll talk to you today is a new technologies and pretty well proven in various areas. Can we put nanostructured materials inside pores? So that'll be the theme of the conference, of the presentations here. So this kind of work is not possible with a lot of different people. Obviously, the major part of the work with our NIH, NIHS, SRP, the center we have. And also I list some companies and students' name, Derek Wan, Anthony Sard, Mingui, and Hernandez. So a lot of students are involved in the project. And some other work of funding also came from Chevron and Southern Company of Birmingham, Alabama. So lecture outline, I can see that quickly go through. And as I mentioned before, if you are familiar with reverse osmosis, for the dissolved water by exclusion of ions. But in this case, we're going to take advantage of the pores. Can we integrate nanoparticles, which doesn't come out actually, inside the pores for reactions and water detoxifications? And then you'll talk about, can you go from a small scale to full scale? And how do you do that? What are some issues you have to be concerned with? And then how do you test membrane system from a lab scale to larger scale? And we'll also discuss some technology transfer from organic compounds to other areas with industries because of NIEHS funding here through the Superfund Research Center program. And then Dr. Ormsby will talk about more on the on-site remediation issues and solutions. So this slide looks like a busy slide, but if you look at the, it's in the top says functionalized membrane, but look at the left side, it says MF. If you're familiar with your home filter, those microfiltration filters are typically maybe 5 micron, 10 microns. But these are here is made of polyvinyl fluoride, which is a very robust polymer. You can get pipes and things, lots of chemicals, lots of product involved, including your lithium batteries, electrodes. So these pores we use about maybe anywhere from 200 nanometer to 500 nanometer. Then somehow think of that, you polymerize the pore inside with polyacrylic acid. And then by adding ions, like iron ions or anything, we can convert to nanoparticles. In this case, happen to be Fe0. But because in the pore domain, you don't agglomerate or you don't lose particles. Then suppose you got a trichloroethylene water, which will Dr. Holmes will talk about afterwards. You can go to ethylene, but you put a second coating of palladium or nickel sometimes. You can also go to SN. And then if you have PCBs on the right side, you can go to biphenyl. And then keep this in mind, you can also take this iron particle and oxidize it. And we have actually oxidized to both magnetite and Fe2O3. And then if you have hydrogen peroxide or persulfate, you can make chlorinated organic acids. Unfortunately, get chlorinated acids. But if you first get biphenyl from here and then do this step, you will get non-chlorinated organic acids. And I'll also show you later on that you can make hydrogen peroxide by using enzyme in a membrane, the enzyme called glucose oxidase, and you can put glucose, you can convert. And the very left side shows we have done full-scale synthesis and also looking at some applications with a southern company, Chevron, a nanostone membrane in Oceanside, California, has been involved with us through patent licensing to make functionalized membranes in larger scale. So next I say, how do you synthesize particles? Well, after you get the PA, PA means polyacrylic acid, there's a lot of carboxylic groups. You can ion exchange iron, for example, but if you want, you can also make silver nanoparticles or copper nanoparticles by defining ion exchanging different things. And then you can reduce this by two nanoparticles using, non-mentally people use borohydride, but I'm going to show you that you can use vitamin C, but this requires presence of palladium, actually. Or tea extract, interesting area is it has polyphenols. And Dr. Varma from US EPA actually did a lot of work in this area. And then you can do a post-palladium or nickel coating. I'm very happy to point out we have in this area, a patent coming out on June 28. And that's the patent number listed there, which has detail over the green synthesis. And if you are interested in knowing more about green synthesis, there was an ACS symposium in the bottom. You might want to look at that book, and which was has a lot more detailed information. So next slide shows that if you do this step, I'm going to go back again. If you do this state of ion exchange, we happen to use a T extract area here, and then indeed you form nanoparticles in the membrane domain, of course. These are about 20 to 30 nanometers, and you can see there's iron sitting here, and of course you put a small amount of palladium, very small here, 3%, and particles are immobilized in the membrane pore, so it doesn't get lost actually, and does not agglomerate. This is a little more detail, and so I show you the steps again. We first make polyacrylic acid, so this chemistry here listed here, you can look at that afterwards. Then you ion exchange sodium, and then you put iron to there, replace the sodium out, then reduce it by borohydride or by tea extract or other chemicals, and you can do post-coating because palladium reacts with iron, you get a particle. So this red color here shows iron particle, this high-resolution TEM, and the small green things here are palladium, actually. And you also have a focused ion beam microscope we recently acquired from Halos. It has a gallium ion and electron beam. You can also look at nanoparticles, actually nanoparticles inside the pore. You can see it very well. And also to point out that you can make particles of other size by changing cross-linking density or different ratio of reducing agent from 68 nanometer to 138 nanometer to anywhere from 20 nanometers. So it's a very versatile platform, again pointing out. We took a microfilter membranes, it could be PVDA or some other material, functionalized it, and made nanoparticles inside, and believe me, it doesn't come out. And it stays in the cross-link matrix, and it does not agglomerate that easily. So now, if I pass water through here from a PCB or TCE, you will get dechlorinated, obviously. So we also let you know, we started to work through a joint agreement. I go there off and on to Singapore Membrane Technology Center. They are expert in full-scale hollow fiber membrane. This is a full-scale, about 100, maybe, I don't know, 250 micron actually thickness. And you can put nanoparticles here, and that shows intact. And this is TC declination sewing using hollow fibers. So we have demonstrated for the first time that you can make flat sheet and hollow fiber membranes in the same technology of functionalizing and reducing the iron or whatever materials you have to nanoparticles. To look at more detail, this came out in a special issue of ACA Sustainable Chemistry and Engineering, honoring Dr. Varma of US EPA, who we collaborated a lot of our research with. And the right side shows that indeed you dechlorinate trichloroethylene. For example, these are surface normalized reaction rate. Depending on the loading, you get up to 0.28 liter per square meter per hour, which is corrected for the surface area. So we discussed about that. Now my question might say, how do you bring from small scale to large scale? This requires a lot of know-how and science. I can't give you all the detail because of some copyright issues with the companies and patent issues. And but bottom line, you have done from here to this full scale. Typically, industries, I know a couple of people signed up here, Dow Chemical Company, other companies. You make 40 inch wide by maybe 10,000 feet long, and then this will be 40 inch wide here. And then you can make module from a smaller module for lab, like 25, this is 6 square foot, to 350 square foot. And we did that with the collaborative work with nanostone membranes in Oceanside, and using fairly simple technique, we sucked the solution in the membrane pore, then went through a certain speed, I cannot give you the speed of rotations, and then enters the oven where polymerization takes place around 85 degrees C. And point out, you can make a module. This is spiral module on the left side showing there. So if you want to pick up a system quickly on your in your lab or power plant, this is a, you can run about a 2 gallons a minute, and you can have two modules here in parallel or put in a series, and this is showing the modules. And also you can build a whole computerized system, which we built it ourselves. This is the computer control on the right side, and you can run it by yourself and go away, and you can analyze the product as long as you have GC mass specs and things. And these are small cells. These are flow-through, cross-flow cells using a small membrane area. And these are batch cells. You can buy a company from Starytech, for example, and you can put a membrane right here, small membrane, to check your membrane containing nanoparticles for dechlorinating TCE and PCBs or whatever it might be. So you can have a small scales, cross-flow, a small power plant, completely computerized systems, depend how much money you want to spend. Now, these membranes have interesting properties. Because it has polyacrylic acid, so it will go through changes by pH. You can change the pore size. That could be a critical area, actually. So this is a membrane containing polyacrylic acid. Look at the flux here, about 700 liter per square meter per hour. That's the industrial unit. When I go to pH 7, goes down to 200. If I make it tight with the cross-linker, I can make it go down to 40. And this is a low pressure. You can make a membrane go to 2 bar also. And just to let you know that this could be an interesting approach, because if some particles get inside from, let's say, groundwater, and you might want to dislodge it, those big particles. So again, the particles are located inside this membrane pore, and that's the behavior because of the carboxylic group ionizing and non-ionizing. Again, for more detail, you can look at these articles. To show you that indeed the membrane works, you can do two ways. You can take the membrane and put in a small cell or shake it up with water containing, in this case, trichloroethylene, actually. But I can also run a convective flow, where the, which you'll show in the next slide, where the water will be pushed through under pressure to change residence time. So this has a small amount of nickel. Palladium, of course, works very well also. You can see that on the left side, you can convert trichloroethylene to ethylene, ethane actually, and by having the membrane pore containing these nanoparticles, which are non-aggregated, and you can do a various repeat cycles here to showing that part. So this is a batch mode. Next one, took an example, we have done PCB 77, PCB 126, and of course this is 2-chlorobiphenyl, little easier one maybe you can say. But now what you're doing, you have the membrane, you're pumping water through the membrane pore. For example, the membrane pore I showed you before, I'll go back one more slide to show you, for example, in this membrane here, you pump it through the membrane, and then what you're analyzing is the permeate. And so notice something, within 50 second residence time, almost complete conversion to biphenyl. And you can change the residence time to the membrane by changing pressure. And the right side, if you're a modeling person, the flow through here is laminar flow, so you can compute the conversion as a function of residence time. And this is a very good approach. Of course, by changing residence time, you can change what product you might form. And the higher the residence time, you'll probably end up getting biphenyl. So you can take the permeate again and do through OCD processes. If you have PCBs, you can also take two different approaches. You can do reductive pathway, like I showed you before, and get biphenyl. Basically, you'll end up getting biphenyl. But biphenyl still is toxic. So you can think of now putting hydrogen peroxide here, we call a combined pathway. Now you can get a non-toxic organic acid by using hydroxy radicals, could be sulfur radical also. By in this way, you prevent forming any chlorinated organic acids. So we actually found it very useful technique. So maybe question come in, can I make hydrogen peroxide by using enzyme on site? So I don't need to buy enzyme, buy hydrogen peroxide. So next slide shows it was published 3 years ago, actually maybe 4 years ago, and published in Proceedings, National Academy of Science. So the concept here is the enzyme with glucose produces hydrogen peroxide, and this will contain iron oxide nanoparticles, which will oxidize organics, whatever might be. In the case of PCBs, will be biphenyl and then oxidize it, or TC or chlorophenol. So let you know that you can have a stacked membrane, one containing enzyme to make hydrogen peroxide, and one containing iron oxide to degrade to further organic acids. And we call these catalytic stacked membranes. And to show you that, that you can also make transfer to other areas. We talked about PCBs, TCEs, but power companies, only the coal-fired power plant, you know they use a lot of water. So you get a huge amount of scrubber water, among large amounts, which may contain selenium, arsenic, etc. And so here is the University of Kentucky. Distance has no barrier. And here is Southern Georgia Power Company. That's a large company. They're probably $65 billion company. And they make power, large-scale power. And this is Nanostone. They make membranes. And recently we published this article in IEC Research. And Dr. Mix is a Southern company. And you can look at a little more detail. So if you see that here, we used before for organic oxidations and reductionized PCBs. But also if you have iron metal here, you can react with selenate and from selenium zero. So because selenium is very low concentration, we have brought it down from 100 ppb, 200 ppb to less than 5 parts per billion. And also please keep in mind that iron has an affinity for arsenic. So you can also remove arsenic from water by using the similar functionalized membrane with this. So if you have a low concentration, you're not going to regenerate. Basically what you will do is take the element out from inside and put a new element in by keeping the same module form. So let you know that we can do this. We also did another work with a large oil company on removing organic acids by oxidizing with the sulfate radical and hydroxy radical through the iron oxide membranes. For a large oil and gas company. So with that, I'm summarizing again maybe a couple of lines before Dr. Osby come in the picture here. And so hopefully I was able to convince you that you have technology there which contains iron zero, or could be other nanoparticles. If you're interested in silver, you can make silver particles. And iron oxide, you could make magnetite also. And or ferrihydrite, and then depend how you pump your solution through And if you go to oxidative pathway, you need hydrogen peroxide, sulfate radicals. If you go to reductive pathway, you need iron zero with a little bit of palladium or nickel, and then you can degrade toxic organics and also apply to other cases like selenium. So I'm going to transfer the podium to Dr. Lyndon Osby, who will talk to you about some remediation issues and applications. Lyndon, this is all yours.
Well, thanks, DB, and I'd like to take just a few minutes that we have left to discuss some of the research translation opportunities that we've explored with this technology. DB has already mentioned some of the collaborations that we've had with Nanostone, Chevron, and the Southern Company. I would briefly just like to mention a few other opportunities that we've looked at, and we've tried to look at a range of facility sizes, all the way from a large surplus site, the Paducah Gas Diffusion Plant, to smaller industrial facilities in the state that have TCE issues, and then all the way down to dry cleaning facilities in the state. As summarized on this slide, in Kentucky, we have about 68 dry cleaner sites. About half of them are over half have releases, and we've been working with our state government to address some of those problems where you have sites. In many cases, that there's not really a sufficient financial base to address those, and so trying to look at cost-effective ways to address some of those types of facilities. By far and away, the largest facility that we've worked at has been the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant. As was mentioned, we've been working at that site since about 1994. This facility was built in the 50s to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. It was only recently shut down, and the site has extensive contamination at it. In particular, there is a massive TCE plume that has two different plumes associated with it. There's also a technetium plume that goes to the northwest, and then there's a massive contamination of PCBs, various transuranics around the site, and so on. What we've mainly been focusing on are ways to address the dissolve phase and some of the source areas with regard to the TCE contamination. This is a very large plume. It's been estimated that the volume of contaminated water is equivalent to about 16,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So you can see there's a lot of contaminated water that is at the site. Currently, there's a significant pump-and-treat operation going on both sides. And so we've been looking for ways that we can work with the responsible party, which is the Department of Energy. And they have a fairly large facility in the northwest corner. This is just a schematic of that system where they're using air stripping for the TCE and an ion exchange for some of the technetium. And we've been looking for ways that we can employ the membrane technology to help sort of optimize that system by making the existing system more efficient or possibly replace some of those particular units. We've also been looking at smaller sites, as I mentioned. In particular, we're working with one site in the city of Louisville where there is a old dry cleaner that has contamination and a large mall. And this facility is kind of interesting. It's actually being driven by economic considerations, not regulatory considerations. The site has actually been transferred to our Kentucky brownfield system, but the owner is having difficulty getting financing from banks for the mall, so we're working with them to try to look at ways to remove some of the PCE in this particular case is the main problem in order to make that a more viable site. I've got one final slide that just tries to encapsulate some of the lessons that we've learned over the years. First, the fact that trying to implement technologies requires a lot of players typically to make that happen. One of the lessons we've learned is it's not enough just to have a good technology that can be patented or even licensed, but you also need additional collaborators or other partners to incorporate your technology into process designs that can actually be then tested and applied at an actual site. And what we found is this will normally mean developing relationships with not only the site owner or the PRP, but the site contractor in many cases, and certainly the regulatory community. So that takes a lot more time and effort than just potentially sometimes doing the lab work to get something that you can demonstrate that works. And there are also a lot of political realities and constraints that typically have to be navigated as well. And in many cases, that might be your largest challenge is figuring out how to work through those to actually get the technology implemented. And so that, I think, is the end of our presentation. At this point, we'd be glad to field any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have a few questions that have come in through the online participants. The first one is, does the water have to be deoxygenated prior to using the nanoscale ZVI dope membrane?
Okay. And that's a very good question, by the way. For the case of iron zero, you know, you have done both ways. You know, obviously oxygen will react in essence. For the case of iron oxide, that's not the issue. But for the case of iron zero, if you do deoxygenate, I would say you get a longer life. That'll be my answer. Can you hear me?
Okay. That actually feeds into our next question that we got, which was, how long does the membrane last, and what compounds may interact negatively?
Okay, we have done work with real water, actually. In other words, not just lab waters, in essence. For example, we have gotten water from Paducah, which contain high hardness, and we have to take out some particles. You know, we take it out from junk particles. And for the case of Southern Company, we are real water, actually. And for Chevron Corporation, we are real waters. And so we have done water, the hardness, and up to about, let's say, 400, 500 ppm and bicarbonate, and we did not see some results leading to issues, and there have been drop of maybe 5-6% of conversion areas, and other than that, we have not seen issues. But so the membrane, in the sense, the question is how long lasts, actually. Well, membrane itself will last for a long time, you know, obviously, but we can also regenerate the particles. I didn't discuss that. So at some point, if I want to rejuvenate, I can pass a sequence of reductant one more through the system, like in this case, only polyphenols. And keep that also in mind that one of the great things of the membrane versus solution phase, the iron 2 or iron 3, when it forms from the reduction, it gets captured by the membrane. So it does not form precipitate on the particle surface. And as a result of that, you get higher longevity.
Great, thank you. So one other question is, can you speak to the timeline of when you had a membrane ready for testing and when you were able to do in-field testing?
In the case of, I'll give you two, one, actually one case I will tell you that it might be going on a full scale in a large company. I would say from the lab studies and things, it might, because this case has a lot of other things involved, and I would say with the real water and thing, probably minimum 5 months to get in the site, probably 1 year or so. Because I think what I'd like to do, know more about the water. If the water chemistry is different, we might decide to put a pretreatment before the membrane system. And so if it is a, like the case of brownfield, they're talking about TC, that water, it could be simpler because that has a PCE, TC only at 20 foot to 30 foot depth. But the Paducah, which is close to 100 feet depth, that makes a big difference. So in this case, they have to pump the water out, by the way. So it goes to the membrane system. So I think that you can bring into practice fairly fast, I think. But I think before I go to on their actual site, we'll probably do some studies in our pilot plant facilities, which you already have at the University of Kentucky.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'd like to take a few minutes now to find out if anyone on the phone line has any questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please remember to take your phone off mute by pressing #6, state your name and organization, and ask your question. After your question's been asked, you can go ahead and remute your phone by pressing star six. We will come back to the phones in a little bit. In the meantime, I have some more online questions. The next one is the membrane capable of dechlorinating water that is also co-contaminated with metals that may sorb to it, something like arsenic and TCE co-contaminants?
Well, okay, that's an excellent question. Hopefully, normally you don't encounter arsenic and TCE at the same time. The places you work with arsenic, selenium with a large company, and that is actually they have iron technology exists actually in some different way. The concentration is very dilute. Typically in the PPBs areas, you have to bring it down to maybe 5 ppb from 100 ppbs. And in those cases, selenium, arsenic works very well, but you have not done any work in the presence of arsenic, TC removal, how it will affect it actually. So I do not know the exact answer to that and whether it will be affected or not. But with arsenic. But normally we have not come across TC, PCBs with arsenic and selenium in the same sites. But we need to look at that. And that's an extremely good question, and I want to thank the person who asked the question. Obviously knows a lot in this area, and we definitely will look into that part. What you might do actually, if the issue develop, this is my plan will be, I'll put a sacrificial membrane first with iron oxide, without containing any, without no palladium iron. The next will be iron palladium, so I'll get rid of arsenic selenium in the first column. The second column with the reactive column for TCEs. So that's your approach will always work. But if I do a combined pathway, I might take a little risk. So I propose the system will be, the membrane module can be put in series very easily. It's very flexible systems. So the first part will be absorbing arsenic, take care of selenium, and the second part will be reactive way, which may contain iron palladium.
Okay, great, thank you. Our next question is, does the nanoscale ZVI oxidize when you add H2O2 forming rust?
Of course, yeah. That's definitely true. Obviously, for the case of the membrane is very robust, PVDF, nothing happens. The iron, the goal of the oxidative pathway is to make iron oxide, in fact. So we have done work with both ferrihydride, Fe2O3, and magnetite Fe3O4. And so we have done with the hydrogen peroxide and also sulfate radicals actually for another applications. And so obviously those cases we definitely oxidize, and oxidized part is what the catalytic reaction with hydrogen peroxide is. So obviously we'll not, when you do reductive pathway, iron palladium, we are not necessarily going to put in the hydrogen peroxide there.
Okay, so our next question is, what regulatory concerns, restrictions have you encountered regarding injecting or using the system in the subsurface?
This is Linda. I'll try to address that. Initially, when we were looking at this technology, one of our ideas for delivery was to basically take nanoparticles and inject them down into the aquifer, but one of the things that we encountered was potential resistance at the time from EPA as well as DOE at the site. This was about 10 years ago. And then so we started looking at two options. One is to basically work with ex situ systems where we could use one of these type of membrane systems. Or another possibility that we've been looking at is once you have the membranes, you can actually cut them up into small pieces basically and get then a medium that can basically be put in situ where you will not have release of the nanoparticles, but you'll still have that reactive capability. And so that is a delivery approach that we have not fully pursued. We've been looking into that, and in the interim we've been focusing on the ex situ approaches, partly because down at the Paducah site, that was the most likely way to address that. But we certainly consider that other approach, and again, partly that has been driven by some of the regulatory concerns of in situ application of nanoparticles.
Right. If I may add one more line to that, what Lindell said, this is what we went through, and obviously we could not have done this work without NIHS, SRC, and lots of people involved. But one of the things we eliminated concern, we check continuously, we do not release nanoparticles. It is firmly embedded in the cross-linked polymers, and only I can release it, I put a strong acid, I would dissolve the iron, basically. So particles don't come out, we measure it comes out or not, and we do look into that part. And so that is the biggest asset for this poor functionalized membrane technology. So if you have a functionalized kind of membrane like hollow fiber, you could chop up hollow fibers also, like spaghettis, hollow spaghettis, for example. Then you got water from inside, outside. We believe that if the particles immobilize in the fibers, and we can inject underneath by cut up fibers. And we're also looking at some electrospin fibers, which are very low diameters, but the particles will be immobilized, does not get released. So I think we have eliminated the regulatory concern on particle release in the environment. At least so far we see that from our experiments in the lab and small pilot plants.
Okay, great. Thank you. I wanted to give the phone lines one more chance. If anyone has a question on the phone line, you can remember that you can press #6 to unmute yourself and ask a question. Okay, if we don't have any questions from the phone lines, we're going to go ahead and get some more online questions. The next one is, I noticed that arsenic was mentioned on one of the slides. What are the highest practical concentrations in the influent in order to achieve the primary drinking water standard of 10 micrograms per liter?
Obviously, keep in mind, the iron oxide arsenic removal is known for years, actually. But when you put a membrane, think of a packed bed, packing with a small particles of iron oxide, you get a very large surface area, and you do pick up arsenic. So we have dealt arsenic easily from about, in this case, we had about 500 parts per billion, and in the water, we brought it down to actually close to 1 ppb's. So we did not look at regenerations, and both selenium also there. So basically, it will stay in service for a long time. And if you're familiar with the membrane modules, you can take it out, the iron based that membrane only, and put a new one in. And if I go to, let's say, 200 milligram per liter, I may have issue in terms of getting saturated quickly. But I will say put a limit, maybe in this case, maybe 1,000 ppb. Bring it down to less than 5 ppb. So influent, if it is 1,000 ppb, that's okay.
Okay, great, thank you. The next question is, what are the range of costs per gallon for treatment using the membrane?
Well, let's put it this way, the cost per gallon. One is a capital cost, one is operating cost. Okay, can I break it down? Capital cost in this case, making the membranes, you found out we can take anybody's membrane line, whether it is if somebody wants to work with us, whether it is some large company like Aeronautics, Dow Chemical, GE, or Nanostone, some smaller companies, we took the regular line where they make membranes like nanofiltration, we can slightly modify the solution phase, we can make it. So we believe we can make membranes highly compatible with the current cost of RONF down to lower levels, you know. The iron, of course, is very, very cheap. So depending on if we need palladium or nickel, and the cost will come in. So if I had to pick a number, I'm kind of hesitant. A capital cost may be in the area of maybe $3 per gallon per day in that sort of capital cost aspects. And operating cost, you know, hydrogen peroxide come in the picture if you use it, and the PCBs, and the palladium loading is we use a very small loading, about maybe, let's call one surface coating in on top of that. If you don't lose palladium, once you put it in, it stays there. So I can't give you the exact cost of the treatment. So I'll be projecting probably in the vicinity of maybe $3 per 1,000 gallon of water.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have some more questions, but we've run out of time for questions right now, so we'll try to get back to some of those questions at the end. A very informative presentation.
And I like the audience, if you can hear me, hear us, we appreciate very much listening us through and for those fantastic, nice questions you posed to us.
Great, thank you. So our next presentation is on advanced composites for in-situ remediation of groundwater and surface water. And we're going to hear from Alexis Wells Carpenter, the principal investigator at Axe Nano, a small business entity that develops early stage technologies to address specific market needs. Dr. Carpenter has a PhD in inorganic chemistry from UNC Chapel Hill, where her dissertation focused on manipulating particle formulations for controlled drug delivery and antimicrobial applications, and two-year postdoctoral experience with Dr. Mark Weisner in the Superfund Research Center and Center for Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology at Duke University, developing zero-valent iron technologies for in-situ sediment remediation and enhanced wastewater treatment. Axe Nano is a sub-entity underneath Triad Growth Partners, LLC, which connects entrepreneurs and scientists to launch or enhance existing technologies and build profitable businesses. With that, we'll turn it over to you, Dr. Carpenter.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Kira. Also wanted to thank Heather Henry for inviting us to this webinar. So as Kira mentioned, I was previously part of the Superfund program at Duke, and there I worked a lot on how to develop and evaluate new nanotechnologies for water treatment systems. And that experience has translated a lot over to what we do here at Axe Nano. And as mentioned in our bio, we are a small business entity that works in the technology transfer space. And so we work with early stage technologies that are developed in a variety of different places and help to transition those out into the marketplace. So before I get into the technology, I'll talk a little bit about tech transfer just broadly. So this is the space that I mentioned that we work in. A lot of our collaborators are research universities. And so this is a slide that I've borrowed from North Carolina A&T, who we work with closely, both the main campus as well as the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering in Greensboro, North Carolina. And this is a nice schematic that shows in a very simple version, the process of tech transfer. And each one of these could probably have a whole presentation on each step. But essentially, you have your research discovery. You document that in some way, disclosure, or disclose to your university, or file provisional. And then you go through some sort of evaluation process, both of the technology and a valuation of what is it worth, is there an actual market need for it, a lot of market research is required. And then along this path, you want to file for IP protection. So you really want to have a good grasp of what are other people doing out there, have people already done this, how is yours different, how is yours better, and are you actually meeting a market need? That's a really key aspect that can be lost a lot. And then as Tom mentioned, partner selection is really key. Very few people are excellent at each step of this technology transfer. And so really to be successful is you want to build a good team. So you want somebody that has good technical expertise, someone that has good business acumen, someone that understands IP landscape is always helpful as well. And then, you know, depending on what market you're going into, so example for remediation, you want to have partners that understand regulatory landscape and in-field remediation testing and all of that. And then once you have determined the success of your technology and you have a value associated with it, there's a variety of different exit strategies that you can have. You can license it. You can have your own company where you produce it yourself, and then eventually getting to that holy grail of commercialization. And then the last thing I just wanted to touch on in terms of tech transfer is this whole valley of death. And so if you've done anything with tech transfer, you've probably heard this term. And it really has to do with the timeline, funds, and your team, in my opinion. So there's a lot of avenues for getting non-dilutive funding to do early stage research and development, such as the SBIR, STTR programs, through a lot of the funding agencies with the government. And you can get to the point where you have a product in hand and you've proven that it's successful, but you still need significant funds, typically debt, to get it out there and into the marketplace. And this requires a lot of sales and marketing and business experience as well. So navigating this valley of death is a big part of tech transfer. And so that's really the space that we work in. Triad Growth Partners is our parent company. And we have a variety of business verticals that help us to navigate that landscape. And then Axe Nano is the technology development group within Triad Growth Partners. And our expertise is in advanced manufacturing, especially in terms of advanced materials. We have a broad knowledge of nanomaterials, nanofibers, nanoparticles. And then we have a number of technologies used for environmental applications, and those are the ones I'll talk about today. And lastly, we're always keeping our eye on the Internet of Things. We understand that the way of the future is going to be all things connected, and that applies even to environmental remediation. So today I'm going to talk about a technology that we are developing out of North Carolina A&T, and it's for contaminated or for remediating contaminated groundwater, at least in the first case, but not selectively. And so most of the people on this call are probably familiar with the issue of contaminated groundwater in the U.S., but I like this map. This was a collaboration between NIH and EPA and Superfund where they developed this interactive tox map that shows all of the sites of contaminated groundwater in the U.S. And you can see that not only is there a lot of them, but they're concentrated around areas of higher population. So that just even further increases the rate of exposure. And so we know that remediation is expensive and it's disruptive. And the responsibility of it falls to if the entity that caused the contamination cannot be identified, then that responsibility falls to the Superfund program. And as we mentioned, it's an expensive process, and so a lot of times it's expensive and takes a long time, and not all of these sites can be remediated, which even further adds to more exposure. And so what we're doing is trying to find low-cost, tunable technologies that can be used to address this issue of faster and lower-cost remediation. A brief comment on the market size of remediation. These two pie graphs are from a publication by Barbara Kahn, where she was basically reviewing nanotech for remediation. But it's a nice illustration of the number of sites that are there. Let me get my pointer going. There we go. So here on the left is number of total sites and who is responsible for them. And then on the right is estimated cost of cleaning up those sites. This was published in 2009, so it's a little dated, but it's a projection up to 2033. And so you can see that EPA is a big portion of that, DOD and DOE, as well as state and private entities, and then civil agencies as well. And the remediation market, at least since 2009, has been continuing to grow annually. And the global remediation market is quite large at $80 billion forecasted in 2019. And so here in the U.S., we have a large number of remediation projects. Europe actually has a really large market as well. They're a little bit ahead of the game in terms of in-situ remediation than the U.S. But this is a large market, and although the technologies that are used now do have some efficacy and have been used for a long time, there's still a lot of room for improvement. And so particularly for groundwater remediation, historically what was done was were ex situ methods where essentially you pump and treat contaminated water, so you remove it, or if it's contaminated soil or sediment, you try to excavate it and treat it or replace it with clean water, clean sediment or soil. And so you can imagine how expensive and disruptive and labor-intensive this is, and in some cases just not possible if the contaminated zone is below a building or a site that is inaccessible to, maybe far enough down below ground that you can't excavate it. And so over the last couple of decades, people have really started looking more at in-situ. And in-situ is believed to probably phase out pump and treat over the next decade or two. And in-situ refers to just treating contaminants as they lie. So this can be done by introducing strong chemicals, either oxidants or reductants, stimulating bioremediation, so introducing constituents that will sort of supercharge the bugs that are already present and facilitate them to degrade contaminants. And then there's a variety of other methods such as thermal or vapor extraction that are used. But for the most part, the most common in-situ method is in-situ chemical oxidation, where you introduce a strong oxidizing agent into the zone of contamination. And for the most part, this is done with potassium permanganate, where you take potassium permanganate, you dissolve it in water, and you inject it directly into the contaminated zone. So this image here is showing a plume, and then the pink is the plume, and then the purple is showing direct injection of the potassium permanganate. And I can't seem to get my pointer to work. Oh, here we go. This is a table showing just the broad spectrum activity of potassium permanganate, so it's effective against a lot of different commonly found contaminants, especially TCE, a lot of chlorinated solvents. It's effective against pHs and organic solvents. And this table doesn't reflect it, but it is effective against some certain pesticides as well. Oxone is another common chemical oxidant that's used as well. And so potassium permanganate has been used for a very long time, and it is broad spectrum and effective at degrading those contaminants that I had listed. But there's still significant problems associated with its efficacy in the field, and these are mostly related to the way that it's deployed. So it's not so much that the chemical is a problem, it's the way that it's introduced into the zone. One of the big problems is that because you're introducing potassium permanganate as a solution, you're limited to solubility as well as shipping regulations. So typically, potassium permanganate solutions are limited to 4 weight percent, usually 2 weight percent. Often it's required to have multiple injections, so since you're limited to these low weight percents, if you have a large plume or high concentration, you have to have multiple injections in order to get enough oxidant there to do total degradation. There's also the issue of manganese oxides that form, and these are basically solid precipitates that will form and clog up pores so that you can no longer introduce more of the liquid permanganate into the zone. You can also imagine that in zones where it's not very porous, that trying to force a liquid would be difficult. And so that's what these images are showing, where if you're introducing into a non-porous zone, you can get this splashback, which would cause exposure to your workers and increase liability and risk. And so what we're developing at Axe Nano is a controlled release platform that is essentially just a new and, we believe, better way to deliver the chemical oxidant for in situ. And so the way that this works is that instead of taking the potassium permanganate and dissolving it in water and introducing it, you take the permanganate as a solid granular, and then you entrap it in a biodegradable polymer matrix. And this allows you to, you can make these pellets, and then you can drill a well and introduce them in the same way that you would the liquid form, but now instead of injecting liquids, you're placing these solid form pellets in the zone of contamination. And there's a lot of benefits for this, mainly that you can introduce much higher concentrations of potassium permanganate per injection. So we can have a range of weight percent loading up to 60 and above 60 if we wanted to. So you can imagine that's lower labor cost associated with having to do fewer injections. You also get longer treatment period with a shorter active deployment. So because these are controlled release, and I'll talk a little bit later about how we can change the polymer matrix to change the rate of release, that means that based on the groundwater flow, the contaminant concentration, different water chemistries that are present at your site, you can control release so that you get specific release kinetics that are needed with only a single application. So really this is taking controlled release that's been used in pharmaceuticals and the medical industry for a long time and translating it to environmental remediation. Another big benefit is that now you have your strong oxidizing agent is encapsulated within an inert polymer. So during shipping and deployment, you have a decreased chance of exposure to your workers. And it also may allow for treatment of dense zones because you're placing in a solid and then allowing groundwater flow and diffusion to result in the release of the oxidizing agent. And so the benefit of these is really tunability. So no two contaminated sites are going to be similar. And so release the release characteristics that you're going to want are going to be driven by your site. And so on the bottom here, this is a picture of our pellets. They're purple from the permanganate that's been loaded in them. We can design them to be any shape or size that we would like. And then we can also tune the polymer that's used to make the matrix. We can use polymer blends. We can use hydrophilic polymers or hydrophobic polymers, all with the goal of tuning release rate. And as I mentioned before, we can tune the oxidant loading from low 20 weight percent up to 60 weight percent based on the contaminant concentration. And then you can imagine that changing the geometry of these pellets will change their release rate as well as their deployment method. So some preliminary work that we've done, as I mentioned, we're in the business of tech transfer. So for the most part, a lot of this work was done in the lab, and now we're focusing on scale-up and field testing. And so this is a graph showing release rate as a function of polymer matrix. And the blue line is a copolymer blend where it's both a hydrophilic and a hydrophobic polymer mixed together used to mix the matrix. And you can see you get higher amount of potassium permanganate release over a shorter time period compared to the more maroon dots, which is a very hydrophobic polymer that resulted in much slower kinetic release. And so this is an advantage if you have slow groundwater velocity or low contaminant concentrations, where you wouldn't necessarily want to release a lot of your potassium permanganate quickly, because then you might form those manganese dioxide precipitates, which would clog pores. We can also tune the amount of oxidant that's loaded. It looks like I lost my legend here, but on the left is a 20 weight percent loaded controlled release polymer, and then on the right was a 60 weight percent. And so over the course of about a month, you can see a difference in the amount of potassium permanganate that's released. And this also shows that we do have sustained release following basically zero order kinetics up to a month. And then we've preliminarily shown the ability of our controlled release polymers to degrade TCE. Again, we're using the same oxidant that is used currently, and so we expect to still see degradation. And this shows that with three different formulations of three different oxidant loadings, you can change the rate of TCE degradation. With the blue is the lower weight percent potassium permanganate, and then going up to the higher weight percent, you get faster TCE degradation. So the next step, now that we have done preliminary work in the lab, is to do a little bit more scale up, a little bit more realistic modeling of these structures to give us an idea of how they will behave in the field. And we're going to evaluate these in two different ways. First, we're going to do a little bit more simple model where we test the release in a porous media, in a basically a chromatography column, where we'll have our controlled release polymer placed in the center, and then we'll flow water in at different rates, different pH, different ionic streaks, and then observe how that changes the potassium permanganate release as a function of water chemistry. This will also allow us to look at how different solids to liquids ratio will affect potassium permanganate release by filling the column with different types of sands and clays and things. And then we can also look at rate of enzymatic degradation versus just hydrolysis of the polymer matrix and how that will affect the structure degradation. And then we can look at contaminant degradation in the same model as a function of not only type of contaminant but also flow rate. So what concentration of oxidant is needed, how many structures are needed in order to fully degrade, for example, TCE, and what flow rates are necessary. And then once we've looked at that, we can also look at a more complex model where we have a much larger, basically, environment that we can still control. And so here we can look at potassium permanganate diffusion in larger domain, both X, Y, and Z. And we can test it again by controlling water in and water out. We can look at different water chemistries again. And all of this will help to govern, once we move to field studies, how we expect well packing to be done, how close do the wells need to be to each other, all of those things. So our next step is, after doing these lab experiments and modeling, is to move on to field study. And so we've partnered with a local engineering firm that has an identified site that's been undergoing pump and treat remediation for about 10 years. And so what we can do is we can introduce these controlled release systems into a well that's already established, and we can monitor their success alongside a traditionally used remediation strategy. And this is nice because monitoring and injection wells are already present, and so we can get it done a little bit more quickly than usual. So that's the controlled release polymers that we're working on. We also have a couple other technologies that I just wanted to really briefly introduce. First is a lead removal nanocomposite. So we all know that lead contamination is a huge problem, especially with the coverage of Flint, Michigan. It's also here in North Carolina a big problem with the coal ash spills and Southern Virginia as well. And then this was actually a collaboration with a researcher who developed this technology in China, where battery lead-acid battery manufacturing and also recycling is a huge industry, and as a result, lead exposure is quite significant. And in the U.S., the CDC actually reduced their level of concern to zero for kids. And current methods for removing lead are basically chelation adsorption, which results in a solid that is now also contaminated with lead and then requires special disposal. So this this composite is a natural composite. It's a natural polymer with iron oxide particles in it. And the natural polymer is modified slightly so that it will absorb lead. And then the iron oxide particles are incorporated within the composite to allow for a mechanism of collection of the composite. And what's really nice about these is that they're recyclable. So you can absorb lead onto the composite, and then you can rinse it with acid to recollect that lead and even possibly reuse it. And then you can continue reusing your lead-sorption composite. And so this graph here on the right shows that absorption efficiency of lead onto our composite essentially remain the same up to 22 cycles. And so there's a variety of instances where a composite like this might be useful. You can imagine putting it, you know, just as an inline plumbing fixture, or as a replacement to the cation exchanges that are used in Brita filters and things like that. But it's really the ability to recycle and reclaim that lead waste so that it's not just going into a landfill, and then also the ability to separate the composites using a low-cost, low-energy magnetic separation. So you could imagine if you had a holding pond or something, you could disperse these, recollect them, and really remediate lead in a responsible, sustained manner. And these composites were tested with some actual wastewater from a lead acid battery manufacturing plant in China and showed 94% removal. Sorry, I just realized that my time is up. I'll go really quickly. We're also working on a NZVI composite where the two big problems with NZVI is that you get surface oxidation, which leads to passivation, and then you can coat the surface, but then you get decreased reactivity. And also aggregation is a big problem. And so we're collaborating with technology out of a government lab where it's a three-component composite where the iron oxide is deposited on a conductive substrate, and then a bimetallic component is included so that we can address both the issue of transport as well as surface oxidation. And this is just showing the ability to remove an organic dye and that the composite was better than the two components alone. This is a summary slide. I'll skip that. We're also working on some nanofibers that can be used for membrane and water filtration. So we can dope different types of nanoparticles into or onto the fibers. And then I was going to talk really briefly about the work that we did at Duke, just looking at cellulose nanomaterials for water treatment. But this is all published in a review. This was in collaboration with Charles, Illinois, and Mark Wisner, where we looked at, we basically compared carbon or cellulose nanomaterials to carbon nanotubes. And there's a lot of application of carbon nanotubes and water filtration, but there's an issue of toxicity and release. And cellulose nanomaterials are a naturally occurring material that have similar strength enhancement properties to carbon nanotubes. And so can we replace them in membranes without having that associated toxicity? So if you have more questions about that, you can look at their review. Okay. This is just showing the increased use of cellulose nanomaterials in water treatment and a couple of their applications. And then this is my contact information, as well as Charles Gauss, who is the founder and CEO of AxNano.
Great. Thank you, Alexis. We have a number of questions. We have a few minutes for questions here. The first one is, how do you determine the radius of influence of the injection? And what is the fate and transport of the granular material?
So the two models that I talked about, the porous media column, those are experiments that we're working on now, and those will directly relate to the radius of influence. And so it's all going to be dependent on what is the polymer matrix, what is the kinetics of degradation of the polymer. That's going to change the release rate of the permanganate, and that's going to affect the radius of influence. And so really, that's our goal of those porous media experiments, so that we can get an idea of what is the radius of influence, and that will govern how we'll deploy these structures. And I think the second part of the question was diffusion of the potassium permanganate granulars. So potassium permanganate is pretty soluble in water, actually very soluble in water. So for the most part, the granulars are not diffusing out of the matrix. The matrix is degrading, water is diffusing in, dissolving the permanganate, and then the dissolved permanganate is coming out.
Okay, great. Thank you. So another question is, how effective is this method in clay matrices?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that's what we're interested in for one of its advantage over the liquid form injection. And that ties back into the radius of influence and those porous media experiments that we have planned. So we plan to look at, in those columns, we plan to change the liquid to solids ratio, as well as the type of solids that we use. So we're going to look at sand and also clays, dense and less dense media. So yeah, that's an excellent question. To be determined.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is, for the controlled release pilot, is an independent lab providing analytical services?
So we have collaborations that allow us access to the analytical labs. So we work closely with ANT and also the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. And they have, I'll put in a plug for them, they have a nanomanufacturing consortium that allows really great collaboration between university and industry. So I guess the short answer is that we're doing it ourselves through instrumentation with collaborators.
Okay, great. Thank you. So one last question. Slow release is a very well known in drug delivery. What biodegradable polymer did you use? For your potassium permanganate results with TCE, what products did you form?
I can't necessarily say exactly what the polymers are, but I will mention that we have looked at five different types of polymers. Some of them are biodegradable, and some of them just undergo hydrolysis. And you can imagine the advantage of biodegradable versus ones that go under hydrolysis, because you might get slower release. The issue is that biomedical grade biodegradable polymers are a little bit more expensive than ones that will just go under hydrolysis.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We're going to move on to presentation now. Our next we'll hear from Thomas Bruton. He's a PhD student in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. His research under the guidance of UC Berkeley SRP project leader David Seedback focuses on chemical oxidation of soil and groundwater contaminants. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in civil and environmental engineering from Iowa State University and Arizona State University, respectively. Today he's going to speak with us about chemical oxidation of poly and perfluoroalkyl substances in groundwater.
Okay, thanks, Kira. Before I begin, I also want to give a big thanks to the folks at SRP for inviting me to share my research here, as well as to my PhD advisor, Professor David Sedlak. With that said, I'll get started telling you about my research looking at chemical oxidation treatment of poly and perfluoroalkyl substances in groundwater. The webinar organizers asked me to explain how my research relates to drinking water treatment, and although this project doesn't deal directly with drinking water treatment, I hope that you'll see that it has important implications for protection of water supplies. As I said, my work is focused on this group of contaminants known as PFAS, which you may have been hearing a lot about lately. PFAS are defined as compounds that contain one or more carbon atoms on which all of the hydrogens have been replaced by fluorine atoms. These fully fluorinated carbon chains are known as perfluoroalkyl functional groups, and their carbon-fluorine bonds are extremely strong. These CF bonds give PFAS high chemical and thermal stability, and they make PFAS both hydrophobic and lipophobic. Because of this unique set of properties, PFAS have been used in large quantities since about the 1950s in applications including textile stain and soil repellents, grease-proof food packaging, nonstick cookware, chemicals manufacturing, and in aqueous film-forming foam used for extinguishing flammable liquid fires. These firefighting foams, which are known as AFFF for short, are the focus of my work. There are lots of different classes of PFAS compounds and a whole list of acronyms that go along with them. So before I get into my research, I want to take a moment to go over the nomenclature and structures of some of the compounds that I'll be discussing. In general, the PFAS can be broken up into three categories. Perfluoroalkyl substances, in which all the carbons on the molecule's tail are fluorinated. The polyfluoroalkyl compounds, in which some, but not all, of the carbons are fluorinated. And then fluoropolymers. The PFAS compounds that have received the most attention as environmental contaminants are the perfluoroalkyl acids, which include perfluorinated carboxylic acids and perfluorinated sulfonic acids. On this slide, I'm showing the structures of the perfluorinated carboxylic acids, or PFCAs. The 8-carbon perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA, has been produced in the greatest quantities over the years, but the different chain linked analogs have also been detected in the environment. Some of those, like the 9-carbon perfluoronanoic acid, or PFNA, were manufactured intentionally, while others of them are more commonly occur as breakdown products of other PFAS. On the next slide, I'm showing the perfluorinated sulfonic acids. Again, the 8-carbon perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, or PFOS, was produced in the greatest quantities, but other chain-linked analogs are out there as well. In general, as the C8 compounds have received more scrutiny as pollutants and have been phased out of production over the past 15 years or so, companies have turned to the shorter chain C4 and C6 chemistries as replacements for the C8. In addition to those perfluoroalkyl acids, there are also a large number of polyfluorinated substances. And these compounds are often made up of a perfluorinated tail linked to a non-fluorinated alkyl group of some kind. Compounds in which the linkage is made by an ethyl group are known as fluorotelomers, like the structure that I'm showing in the top left here, while compounds that contain a sulfonamide linkage are called perfluoroalkane sulfonamides. And there's a lot of chemistry going on there, but the important thing to remember about polyfluorinated compounds is that they can break down into perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS. And for this reason, they're often referred to as perfluoroalkyl acid precursors. And just to maybe step back a minute, the reason that we're concerned about PFAS is that some of them have been shown to be persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. PFOA and PFOS have been studied the most, and both have been shown to be resistant to environmental degradation mechanisms. Because they have a long environmental half-life, they're subject to long-range transport and have been detected in waters and biota all around the globe, even in regions far from where they're used and produced. Both PFOA and PFOS are known to bioaccumulate, and both have been linked to a number of health effects in animal and epidemiological studies. The EPA recently announced a new lifetime health advisory of 70 nanograms per liter combined for PFOA and PFOS. While this advisory is technically non-enforceable, many affected utilities are treating it seriously and are taking steps like shutting down wells and changing source water blends to reduce the concentration of these chemicals in the finished drinking water that they're providing. The map in this slide shows recent EPA monitoring data collected under the third unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, or UCMR3. Under this rule, many water utilities around the country were required to sample for 6 PFAS compounds and report the results to EPA. The compounds tested were the C4, C6, and C8 sulfonates, and the C7, 8, and 9 carboxylates. The counties that are shown in red here all had detections above the method reporting limit for at least one of the compounds. And while this isn't the final data from the UCMR3 efforts, even from this preliminary map, you can see that PFAS occurrence is widespread. And if these compounds are being detected in municipal water supplies around the country, it begs the question, where are they coming from? So far, documented sources of PFAS to surface and groundwater include manufacturing facilities, wastewater treatment plants, landfills, and sites where aqueous film-forming foam was used. So now that we've covered that background, we can get into what I really want to talk about, which is treatment techniques for removing PFAS from groundwater. PFAS are not volatile, so they can't be treated with air stripping. Biodegradation pathways have been elucidated for some PFAS, but the terminal degradation products are often other types of PFAS, like the perfluorocarboxylates. So to date, bioremediation doesn't seem to be a good option. Pump and treat remedies, followed by ion exchange or adsorption to activated carbon, are currently the most common technique used. But these processes are expensive, and they're not as effective for the shorter chain compounds, like the C4 carboxylates and sulfonates. And so because many of the methods in the sort of standard remediation toolkit are ineffective for PFAS, there's a real need for other alternatives. And in-situ chemical oxidation, or ISCO, is one that holds promise. Let's see. As Alexis explains during her presentation, ISCO is the delivery into the subsurface of a chemical oxidant to react with organic contaminants. And the advantage of ISCO compared to some other methods is that it can actually destroy the contaminant, not just transfer it to another phase. And as a result, there's no need for regeneration or disposal of media like there is with ion exchange or activated carbon. Also, ISCO, like the name implies, is done in place, and there's no need for extraction of large amounts of groundwater. Two of the most common oxidants used in ISCO are hydrogen peroxide and persulfate. Both peroxide and persulfate are strong oxidizers on their own, but they become especially useful when they're activated into short-lived, highly reactive free radical species, like hydroxyl radical and sulfate radical. Our research group has been studying these processes for quite a while now. For instance, my former colleague Ayn Pham did his PhD work on peroxide activation, and myself and others have done similar research looking into persulfate activation through reactions with metal oxides and aquifer sediments. Even my advisor did his PhD on Fintan treatment, actually. So when we started to hear about efforts to destroy perfluorocarboxylates with oxidative treatment, we got interested in this idea. For example, there was a paper that came out in ES&T Letters about 2 years ago showing that hydrogen peroxide could degrade PFOA through reactions with radicals like superoxide and hydroperoxide. And that's the paper Mitchell et al. That I'm showing on the left here. There's also a body of work from a group in Japan showing that sulfate radical could oxidize PFOA all the way to mineralization, generating fluoride and CO2. These results were promising and they're very interesting to us, but they also confused us because of some of what we knew from our own research. And relating to that, during her PhD, my former lab mate, Dr. Erica Houts, developed a procedure known as the total oxidizable precursor, or TOP assay. And TOP converts polyfluorinated compounds, that is those PFAS where the carbon backbone is not fully fluorinated, into perfluorinated compounds like perfluorocarboxylates. The polyfluorinated compounds are often quite difficult to measure because we don't have analytical standards for them. So by converting them into the PFCAs that we can measure more easily, we can determine how much PFAS there was in the original sample. I won't go into the details too much, but basically the process uses heat-activated persulfate at high pH to overwhelm the sample with hydroxyl radicals. The hydroxyl radicals react with the non-fluorinated portion of the precursors, but they leave the perfluorinated part of the molecules intact. And so, for example, Erica found that performing the TOP assay on a fluorotelomer type precursor, let me find the pointer here, this molecule here, with a C8 fluorocarbon chain, resulted in production of PFOA and a suite of shorter chain PFCAs, so these molecules over here. The PFCAs were stable end products. That is, there was no decrease in their concentration over time, even with more treatment. And so by measuring the amount of PFCAs produced, Erica could back calculate the amount of C8 precursors that were originally present in her sample. And the important thing I want to note here is that the reason the PFCAs were stable end products is that they did not react with hydroxyl radical. Here's what Erica's data looked like when she tested samples of fluorotelomer-based AFFs with TOP. So this is four different formulations of AFFF from three different companies. Both of these graphs are showing concentrations of perfluorocarboxylates. On the left, we see that prior to oxidation, none of the formulations contain any measurable PFCAs. What we see is on the right is that post-oxidation, polyfluorinated precursors had been converted into PFCAs. So what all of this tells us about treating perfluorocarboxylates like PFOA with hydroxyl radical is that it won't work. And knowing that, I decided to go back and look at this paper that had talked about treating PFOA with peroxide and repeat some of those experiments and see what results I got. Using the protocol that they described in their study, I saw significant PFOA loss in the peroxide treatment compared to the control, as I'm showing here in this graph. And this essentially replicated the other group's results, which I'm showing there. But I wasn't totally satisfied with this because I had expected to see shorter chain PFCA transformation products, but I didn't detect any. Also, I noticed that this protocol caused iron oxide colloids to form and precipitate out in my vials. When I went back and resuspended those colloids and extracted them with methanol, I didn't observe the product compounds there either. But what I did observe was nearly full recovery of that PFOA that had seemed to be lost. So it turned out that this PFOA removal I had observed originally was due to sorption on those colloids and not reaction. And seeing that, I gave up on Fenton treatment of PFCAs and moved on to persulfates. I did some initial experiments with PFOA and persulfate at room temperature. And under these conditions, persulfate is activated to sulfate radical slowly. And the pH drop that naturally accompanies that process also happens slowly. This graph shows pH in red, and the black points are the sum of C4 to C7 PFCAs, which are the expected transformation products of PFOA. What I saw is that production of the short chain products did not start until the pH drops below right about 3.4, as I show with this red cross here. This was reproducible in other experiments with slightly different conditions, And it made us think that perhaps pH plays a key role in this reaction between sulfate radical and the PFCAs. This made sense to us because we knew from our prior work with the TAPASE that persulfate at alkaline pH does not transform PFOA. I moved on to do some carefully controlled experiments with persulfate buffered at different pHs. And I should point out that the x-axis here is not treatment time anymore, but the amount of persulfate consumed in the experiment. When I dosed PFOA sequentially with 10 and then 20 millimolar of persulfate at pH 8, I saw no loss of PFOA except for some initial sorption and no generation of short-chain products. However, when I did this at pH 3, I saw a small amount of PFOA transformed to the C7 perfluorocarboxylate after 10 millimole, and after 20 millimolar of persulfate, there was more C7 and a small amount of C6. So something different was definitely going on at pH 3 compared to pH 8. When I did the experiment without any buffer and allowed the pH to drop to less than 3, I saw even more transformation products. And after 50 millimolar of persulfate, I began to see what looks like PFOA mineralization. A caveat that I should mention here is that the reactions are almost certainly producing C3 and C2 carboxylates as well, but I don't have data for those compounds because until recently, they were slightly more difficult to measure. I should also point out that these experiments were done at an elevated temperature of 60 or 85 degrees C so that their reactions would move faster. I know that probably seems pretty hot, but it turns out that it's actually well within the range that's commonly achieved in the field during in-situ thermal treatments. On the next slide, I show you what the process looks like in time course. This experiment used 50 millimolar of heat-activated persulfate and was done in DI water without any buffering, so the pH dropped rapidly to below 3. On the left, I'm showing the concentration of persulfate, and the bar graphs on the right are PFOA and its shorter chain transformation products. We observe rapid destruction of PFOA. We see initial spikes in the concentration of the C7 and C6 PFCAs that decrease over time as they react further. And by the time the persulfate is all gone at 6 hours, what's left is a mix of mostly C4, 5, and C6 PFCAs. The overall loss of measurable PFCAs in this experiment totaled to 75%. So we knew that sulfate radical at low pH reacts with PFOA in pure water. But obviously, no one needs to remediate PFOA in just pure water. So my next step was to repeat these experiments in the presence of aquifer sediments to try and make them more representative of conditions in situ. I used a slurry containing 200 grams per liter of sediment, and in this case, I added two sequential doses of 50 millimolar persulfate. The figure on top here is persulfate concentration, and underneath are PFOA and its transformation products. If you look only at the pink bars, you can see that most of the PFOA was degraded with the first dose of persulfate, and that PFOA was completely removed after the second dose. And then on the other hand, if you do the accounting in terms of total perfluorocarboxylates, or the sum of PFOA and its transformation products, removal was 32% after the first persulfate dose and 63% after the second. This shows that low pH persulfate treatment is effective at destroying PFCAs even in the presence of aquifer sediments. This figure is a summary of what I've shown you so far about PFOA degradation. I plotted PFOA in blue here and the sum of perfluorocarboxylates in pink. And what we see is that we had near complete removal of PFOA after 50 millimolar of persulfate treatment in DI water and after 100 millimolar of persulfate treatment in sediment slurry. However, when we look at the data in terms of total measurable PFCAs, we see that about 20 to 70% of those original fluorocarbon chains still persist after treatment in the water and sediment experiments, respectively. And even though not all the PFCAs were removed under these particular experimental conditions, I think that these results are really hopeful, and they suggest that persulfate ISCO is a viable treatment for perfluorocarboxylates in situ. But obviously, perfluorocarboxylates are not the whole story. We know that the majority of PFAS sites are contaminated with more than just the PFCAs. We also know that PFCAs were only minor components of many of the aqueous film-forming foam formulations, and that other PFAS, such as the sulfonates or the polyfluorinated compounds, often dominated in those mixtures. So I've also done experiments using actual AFFF. On this next slide, I'm showing data for heat-activated persulfate oxidation of a sample of AFFF made by the Ansel company that was diluted in pure water. The main starting PFAS compound in this formulation is known as LODINE, and the technical name is 6,2-fluorotelomer dioetheramidosulfonate. When I subjected this AFFF to oxidation, I observed immediate disappearance of that parent compound and rapid production of C7 to C4 PFCAs. Over the course of the experiment, the C7, C6, and most of the C5 compounds disappeared, leaving only a small amount of PFCA at the end. So what this tells us is that for sites where only fluorotelomer type AFFF was used, persulfate is a promising treatment. The results were not quite as promising when I tested heat-activated persulfate on a sample of AFFF from the major predominant AFFF manufacturer, which was 3M. This figure shows only the data for the perfluorosulfonates in this AFFF experiment. And we see that aside from some lost absorption at the beginning, the concentration of PFOS and of the C6 sulfonate was unaffected by the persulfate treatment. This next plot shows just the carboxylate measurements from that same experiment with 3M. This formulation contains almost no perfluorocarboxylates initially, but after the oxidation begins, we see an initial rise mainly in the C6 carboxylate, the green bar, and that's generated as C6 sulfonamide precursors are oxidized. Now, I don't have standards for these precursors, so my measurements of them are only semi-quantitative, and I don't show them here. The important thing is that they're converted to perfluorocarboxylates, which the persulfate then destroys. So the silver lining for 3M AFFF is that low pH persulfate treatment can remove at least a portion of the PFAS that are present, even if it doesn't touch that PFOS, or those sulfonates. Okay, we've come to the end. In summary, I found that the PFOA loss I observed in my experiments with Fenton's reagent was due to sorption and not oxidation. I found that persulfate, in addition to converting polyfluorinated precursors to perfluorinated carboxylates, can also further degrade those carboxylates, but only at low pH. I also found that aquifer sediments reduce the efficiency of this process, but they don't stop it. Finally, none of the treatments I tested had any effect on PFOS or other perfluorosulfonates. As far as directions for future research, I think there's work to be done developing a better mechanistic understanding of this reaction between sulfate radical and the carboxylates, because if we understood the details of that reaction, we might be able to devise more effective treatments. And very importantly, I think there's a need for more pilot or demonstration scale projects in this area, because the number of those type of projects so far is very limited. In closing, I'd like to acknowledge all the great help I've had from my colleagues. Professors Jennifer Field, Chris Higgins, and Lisa Alvarez-Cohen contributed to this work when we were teammates on a former startup project. And then Erica Houts, Katie Harding, and Shan Yi taught me everything I know about how to measure PFAS. And of course, we couldn't have done it without the generous funding from CERTIP and the UC Berkeley Superfund Center. Thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions now.
Great, thank you very much. We have a question that's come in online. What was used to activate the persulfate?
Okay, good question. That's an important one. And in my experiments, the persulfate was activated with heat. So I did this work in a water bath, mostly at 85 degrees Celsius. And that activates the persulfate rapidly enough that we get a lot of sulfate radicals and a high enough concentration of sulfate radical to attack PFOA and these other compounds. I've done experiments with iron, for instance, to activate the persulfate, and that iron scavenges a lot of the sulfate radicals that are produced, and so the process does not work as well under those conditions. And I hope it's clear from my presentation, if if you tried to do base-activated persulfates to treat PFOA, the pH of the aquifer would be high, and so you'd have hydroxyl radical mainly instead of sulfate radical, and I wouldn't expect any degradation of perfluorocarboxylates.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have two questions that are basically very similar. They both have to do with whether you have approached or identified any potential sites for pilot scale testing.
Good question. We're actively pursuing opportunities to do that, but we haven't identified anything quite yet. We put in a couple of proposals with various organizations, but we don't have a specific plan yet, no.
Okay, great, thank you. Next question is, how fast is the reaction before you start losing the sulfate radicals?
Well, the sulfate radicals, just by their very nature, are quite short-lived, and so there needs to be a large dose of persulfate that's constantly being activated into sulfate radicals. Because as soon as the persulfate is turned into a sulfate radical, the sulfate radical is going to find whatever chemical species is around and react with it, essentially. So it's not going to persist at all. And so as soon as that persulfate is activated into sulfate radical, the reaction goes quite quickly. It's just a matter of what other chemical species are around to suck up and scavenge those sulfate radicals other than your target contaminant.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next one is your work and your presentation were excellent. Thank you. Do you believe we will see successful commercial scale ISCO application for PFAS in the next year or two or ever?
It's hard to say about whether this will happen in the next year or two. I do strongly believe that this type of treatment has a place in the suite of techniques that are going to be used to address these sites, especially because a lot of the AFFF fire training areas have presumably source zones with higher concentrations of both PFOA, PFOS, and these polyfluorinated compounds that we perhaps not even identified. And so there are source zones where these polyfluorinated compounds are hanging out. And I think that a persulfate ISCO can help drive all those to perfluorocarboxylates and perfluorosulfonates that A, we can recognize, and B, we can deal with, whether it be through further oxidation treatments or a pump and treat with activated carbon. But I definitely think that in the long term, ISCO will have a place at the table.
Okay, great, thank you. I want to just take a second and find out if there are any questions coming in from the phone lines. Please remember to take your phone off of mute by pressing #6 if you have a question. Okay, sounds like there are none. So the next question is, how is degradation to shorter chain PFCAs conducive to remediation? Wouldn't we be concerned about increased mobility and similar health effects?
My answer to that is absolutely. And I think one of the things that I've tried to do in my work is show that you really have to think about these transformation products, and just looking at PFOA disappearance, for instance, is not a very useful metric. These shorter chain compounds, while there's not as much toxicity data out there for them, they are equally persistent as the longer chain compounds. They move faster in groundwater because the perfluorocarbon chain length is less and they sorb less. And the health effects are sort of an open question at this point. So what I would say is that if you're going to remediate a PFOA site with ISCO and chop it up into smaller and smaller perfluorocarboxylates, good monitoring and a good understanding of all the transformation products is really essential. You have to make sure that these compounds are getting all the way to mineralization. It's quite important to think about the transformation products. I think that's a really good point.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is, I know peroxide alone was not successful. Did you try any peroxide activation of the persulfate?
I did not try any peroxide activated persulfate for PFAS treatment. I know that there are some folks out there that have done some hybrid activation approaches and have some promising data sets, but I haven't done anything with that, no.
Okay, I have that's the end of our online questions right now, so we'll wait and see if we get any final ones, but I have a question for you. Do you envision this as being something that would be applied in situ, or that it would be more conducive to having more like a controlled treatment cell where it was more flow through groundwater treatment?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And my answer is that I have envisioned this as something that would be applied in situ. And the reason for that is like I mentioned earlier, the source zones where these contaminants exist, the contaminants are there in large suites of different compounds, including these sulfonates and carboxylates that we have analytical methods for, but also including some of the polyfluorinated compounds that we don't know how to measure. And so by doing this ISCO, we'll react with all of those compounds and we'll drive those precursors that we can't measure into perfluoroalkyl acids that we can measure, and so get a better handle on the overall mass removal over time in the subsurface. And you know, obviously we can't do a good job treating what's there unless we know what's there. And I think that treating ISCO, using ISCO treatment to drive precursors into perfluoroalkyl acids can help us get a handle on that. That being said, I think that sulfate radical ex situ treatment systems, there's potential for that as well. I just know that there's a lot of movement in the remediation industry to move towards in situ remedies. So that's why we focused our work that way.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I'll give this one more chance if anybody on the phone has any questions. Okay, we are coming up near the end of our time. So before we conclude, we want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs, the pod which contains the seminar resources and the seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I'd also like to remind participants of various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, join the Cleanup Information Network LinkedIn group, visit the SRP Progress and Research webpage, or follow SRP NIEHS on Twitter. I'd also like to encourage everyone to join us next week for the third session of this series, Session 3. We will feature SRP-funded projects that are developing innovative technologies for the monitoring of hazardous substances in water. The presentations will highlight potential non-targeted testing, passive sampling, and bioanalytical approaches to detect a wide variety of contaminants in water. with applicability to drinking water. Presenters will also discuss results from certain targeted contaminants such as phthalates, trichloroethane, and dioxins. We'd also ask that you save the date for an upcoming session on July 21st at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Session 4 will focus on communicating risk and engaging communities around arsenic and well testing. Registration for this seminar will be open soon. So it's now approaching 3 o'clock, so we're going to have to conclude this webinar. If you have any additional questions, you can contact us via email. Our email addresses are on the seminar homepage on Clouin. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we will respond to all of those via email. I'd also like to thank our presenters, Dr. Deepak Bhattacharya, Dr. Lindell Ormsby, Alexis Carpenter, and Thomas Bruton. That concludes today's presentation, and thank you for your participation.